Alternative fees continue to be a prominent topic among lawyers. Our next several podcasts will feature interviews that Ed has conducted over the last 18 months with prominent thinkers on the subject. Jeff Carr, General Counsel of FMC Technologies, responds here in the first of two interviews with him. In today's world, the preeminent method of billing is still based on the hour. It's not the way that lawyers have billed traditionally. It used to be that bills were given on a bottom line for value rendered services. Changes resulted largely by corporate counsel and insurance counsel in the 1970s, or perhaps more so in the early 1980s, when people were frustrated with that kind of billing system. We went to the billable hour as a way to impose some cost control and as a way to understand the way law firms were billing us. Now, of course, we've got a whole generation of lawyers who know nothing else at this point. Jeff Carr discusses this new horizon.
But Jeff, many lawyers believe that corporate counsel are merely trying to lower the legal costs and that there's really no benefit to the lawyer. Can you describe some of the benefits to the lawyers as well as to the corporate world?
Sure. I hear that all the time when because we do most of our work on an alternative fee basis here at FMC Technologies, and people are always saying, well, Jeff, you're just looking for a discount. And that's not true. We actually want to pay firms a higher effective hourly rate. We just don't want to buy as many hours, and we want it somewhat conditioned upon their performance. And performance is a factor of many different things. It's communication, satisfaction of our business objectives, use of technology, their overall knowledge. There's some subjective criteria in there as well as simply winning. My feeling is, first, we're helping to improve the firm's performance, and they should embrace that. If they live in a world that favors and rewards continuous improvement, they should embrace this. Secondly, just from a pure economic standpoint, if we're willing to pay more per hour but for fewer hours, what we're doing is increasing their margin on those hours and giving them hours they can sell to somebody else. We're freeing up their inventory to sell to somebody else.
Well, one of the critical elements of alternative billing, as I understand it, is that the lawyer's got to move away from his or her attempt to be perfect.
Right.
That the mode of leaving no stone unturned that we learned in law school is no longer applicable. But this also suggests that the client's going to absorb a certain amount of risk. How can that risk be defined in advance of the engagement?
Mm-hmm.
And as a skeptic, do you really believe that the lawyer will be immune from a malpractice suit if the result hoped for by the client doesn't actually occur?
Yeah, that's a great question, because that's what you hear often as the defense of why we have to do work this way. I mean, first, the rules of professional conduct require us as members of the bar to zealously represent the client. And that, that old canon, used to be a canon, now it's a rule. Many a billable hour has been spent in the name of zealous representation of the client. So that's on the one side. The flip side is, well, we got to do this, otherwise we get sued for malpractice. I think the answer is that the client does have to absorb a certain amount of risk, and they have to understand that. At least in my world, I look at myself as the head of the FMC Technologies law firm. Lawyers that work for us on the outside, they're the head count that I can't afford to have on the inside. And when we engage them, an outside lawyer versus one of my inside counsel, they're the same. I just pay them in a different way. One I pay in a paycheck, and the other I pay against an invoice. But as far as I'm concerned, they're members of my legal team. That legal team, along with the internal client, sits down and decides what the strategy is going to be in the case, what our objectives are, or if it's not a case, in the transaction, whatever the legal matter may be, what our objectives are and what resources we're going to put on it, and understanding what the deltas are. You know, that we could spend another 1,000 hours, but it's only going to increase the probability of success by 5%. That's a risk we're willing to take. And you got to have that conversation. Frankly, if you have that conversation, and if you make sure that the in-house lawyers, along with the firm lawyers, along with the internal client, are all sitting at the table and deciding what approach to take, frankly, you're all dirty if something goes wrong. You know, you're all part of that decision-making process, and we're not going to sue for malpractice in that kind of a circumstance.
well, you say you're not going to sue, and I hear you, and I believe you going in.
Right.
But now we're at the other end of the tunnel,
right.
And you're really ticked off. You're pissed, as they say,
yep.
that the result came down, the judge did this, or the other side did that, what have you. And who are you going to look for? The lawyer on the outside, because you can't sue yourself.
That's a legitimate fear and a legitimate concern. I can't speak for others. I can only speak for the way we've handled this kind of a situation. We had a piece of litigation that went bad. The judge made some outrageous determinations during trial. We lost about a $3.5 million verdict. Instead of firing the law firm and hiring somebody else for the appeal, we rode the same horse through the appeal, and we prevailed on appeal and had it reversed. Our feeling is we're loyal to our lawyers and people that work with us. I think a lot of this comes down to client expectations and understanding how to manage those expectations. I describe most legal work, particularly in litigation, as being like a weather person.
My goodness.
And when the client asks you, are we going to win, or are we going to lose, whatever the question is, they'll push you for a percentage. I mean, most lawyers want to say it's more likely than not. Who knows what that means? Or you've got a good case. To an outside lawyer, that may mean a 25% probability of success. To the client, they may be hearing a 75% probability of success. So unlike most lawyers, we actually give people probabilities. We say, if they want to hear it, we'll use a decision tree, and we'll say, you have a 62.578 probability of success in this matter, or a probability of getting this number or losing that much. We will actually go through that exercise. The only thing I know about that exercise is that I will always be wrong. It's never exactly what we predicted. But that's exactly what the weather person does. When the weather person says there's a 5% chance of thunderstorms, 95% probability that it's going to be a beautiful day, if you're standing in a downpour, you're pissed at the weatherman. But the fact is, the weatherman was right. You're in the 5% zone. And that's the way you have to deal with this with the clients.
With respect to the weatherman, though, and now many weather women.
Yes. I try to say weather person. Sometimes
right,
I'm not good at that.
Right. There's no recourse. But when you're looking at the lawyer, all of a sudden the lawyer is naked. There is recourse, and that's by way of the malpractice action.
Yeah, and we've never been asked to give a representation or a warranty that we would not sue for malpractice. It'd be an interesting question. I'm not sure how we'd handle it. We base our relationships on trust, quite frankly, and the personal relationship with the counsel. We're very loyal to the few number of firms that we work with, and that's just part of the bargain for exchange. I know my job is on the line if we lose, and that's the way I look at the world. It's my decision and my responsibility. Ultimately, if something goes wrong, it's not the firm's, in my view.
Jeff, let me switch our focus slightly. If one of the principal ingredients of alternative billings is that fees are paid by value, not by who sets the value.
Mm-hmm.
If the client sets the value, how does the client get educated to understand what the value of the service is?
Mm-hmm.
For that matter, how does a lawyer get educated to understand what the value of the service is?
Right. And oftentimes, It's hard to focus on this in value, I think. People tend to think of the world, when they're talking about value billing, more in the world of litigation, I think, than anything else. Writing a will, as an example, or giving tax advice. Tax advice actually is one of the best ones where you can say the value. If it saves this much money in taxes, there's a pretty clear value there. But on the other hand, in litigation, I think what you've got to basically say to folks, you got to sit down and you say, it's not just money. It's what are your objectives in this case? Is it winning by this much? Is it only losing by that much? Is it getting an injunction? Is it getting your patent enforced? Is it making sure that your patent is not declared invalid? What precisely is it that you're looking for? And that's what we try to focus on. That's the element of success. We don't focus on value as much as we focus on what is the objective. Once we know what the objective is, then you can tell the firm, hey, this is my objective. This is the situation. How much is it going to cost? Give me your best guess on how much it's going to cost. Break it down into the components of a case or the components of a transaction, and give me a budget by phase on what it's going to cost to get there. If the number is too high, what that means, then the client has got to make a decision as to whether or not, wow, it's going to cost me that much, maybe, to achieve this result. That either is or isn't worth it to me. And the client's got to make that decision. And so I think all of this comes down to a true communication and a true exchange of what things actually can cost. It doesn't do a client any good at all for a firm to come in and lowball a matter, to say, I can do this for $20,000, or I can do this for $100,000, if it ends up costing $250,000. Now, if it ends up costing $250,000 and there are reasons for it, and the client has been involved in why that has happened throughout, that's okay. The client's going to be sitting there saying, is this still worth it to me or not? And they'll decide to pull the plug, or they'll decide on some alternative course.
So what you're suggesting, if I'm hearing you correctly, is that one of the key elements here is to create a budget of events and then a budget of money.
Absolutely.
As to what it's going to cost.
Absolutely.
And that budget, in terms of events and benchmarks and so forth, that's clear to understand. In terms of the budget for money, though, what number are we using? Are we going back to the hourly rate and then coming up with the number?
In our system, yeah, that's exactly what we do. It's very interesting. I mean, we've come to the conclusion that for better or worse, we're stuck with the billable hour. It's a good surrogate for time effort expended in a matter. And so we still use the billable hour, but what we do is we try to put part of that compensation always at risk, and then you get that amount back plus a bonus based upon, and plus a variable bonus based upon efficiency and success. So in other words, if you tell me a matter is going to cost $1 million, you achieve success for $500,000 as opposed to $1 million. In terms of what your billed amount was, what we would have done in that circumstance is we would have paid you $400,000. We would have withheld $100,000. That would be in the at-risk bucket. Success was achieved. You'd get that $100,000 back. You'd probably get, depending upon when you achieve success, another $100,000 in as a success bonus, and then there'd be an efficiency bonus on top of that for bringing the matter in 50% below expected cost.
So in other words, if we're using the $1 million example, you're saying that you would pay only 50%, and then...
No, actually, what we normally pay is we pay 80 cents on the dollar.
Okay.
We put 20% at risk, and then depending upon when success is achieved, you know, that at-risk bucket is growing. And then if success is not achieved, you lose what's in the bucket. If success is achieved, you get what's in the bucket plus a success bonus plus an efficiency bonus or an efficiency penalty. You know, if you overran, you might take a ding on your bonus because you overran the total budget on the case.
Now, who sets these? It's clear that the 80% figure is established up front.
Yeah.
The bonus bucket entries or withdrawals, are they subjective, or are there some standards that are set up so that the lawyer has some objective criteria?
They can. Well, let's just in a litigation context, for us anyway, we use a system. We call it ACES. It stands for the Alliance Counsel Engagement System, subject to a pending business process patent. But it takes this 80% figure that we pay. You give us a budget. Five phases in a case. You give us a target for each one of the phases. During the phases, we pay 80 cents on the dollar. And then depending upon when success is achieved, you get what's in the bucket plus a bonus. And the bonus depends upon the phase. If you achieve success in the first phase, you get what's in the bucket plus 100%. If you're in the second phase of the case, it's what's in the bucket plus 75%, and so on. The lowest bonus is 25%. I mean, we gotta incent people to play in this world. The interesting thing part about our system is that if in any phase you get to the point where you're going to go above your target for that phase, we don't want you to stop work. You know, we want the firm to continue to do work. But say you're in discovery and you say, you know, I really need to take that one more deposition, but I'm going to be above my target. What we say is fine, take the deposition, but if you go above the target, now the ratio of pay switches. And now we pay you 20 cents on the dollar and 80 cents goes in the bucket. What that does is it forces the law firm to make tactical decisions in the interest of the case. In other words, they're only going to do those things that are going to materially contribute to success. Now their success bucket is growing. And so if they think that it's going to work, they're willing to put that 80 cents now in the success bucket. And then depending upon what phase they're in, they get the bucket back plus a bonus. Then depending upon how efficient they were in the overall case budget, they might get an efficiency bonus, or there might be an efficiency penalty. All this does is align their interest in maximizing revenue, maximizing profits, in our interest in achieving success as early as possible.
I was going to ask you about the concept of beauty in the eye of the beholder, if mm-hmm. beauty, in this case, value, is in the eyes of the client, mm-hmm. then how do you reconcile differences of opinion
yeah,
of value?
Great question. In the litigation context, you don't, at least in our world, because we do this quantitatively. You know,
there's some objective criteria set out.
There's an objective criteria. Now, in every other situation, we use a different form of ACES. It's called ACES Long Term or ACES LT. Think of that as a report card system. What we do there, and this works for transactions, it works for just straight hourly billing, fixed fee, works for anything. What we do is we say, okay, here's the project or here's the retainer. Here's our deal. We've come to a deal on either hourly or fixed fee, whatever that may be. You give us a bill, we pay you 80 cents on the dollar, 20% goes at risk. Periodically, or at the end of the engagement, either one, we give you a report card. And the report card is based on five different factors. And they are subjective. I won't kid you. They are subjective. But each of those factors are weighted equally. And then depending upon how you do on your report card, you get between 0 and 200% of the amount withheld. So what the firm does, the firm realizes anywhere from 80% to 120% of its total amount billed. What that forces us to do as the client is to give meaningful feedback to the firm about what our expectations are and whether they're meeting them. And the criteria we use are things like communication, teamwork, innovation, satisfaction of our business objective, and knowledge. Those are our basic criteria. Those happen to be the same five core values FMC has as a company. When we think about what our core values are, it's those five things. What we've done now is we've said, here's what those five things mean to us in buying legal services. And if you do stellar performance, you're going to get your bill plus another 20%.
Jeff, your concepts are mind-boggling in the legal profession and I think right on in the business world. I'm not sure how many corporations, though, even in the business world, honor the core values that you describe. But taking it to our issue at hand more directly, it seems to me that underlying this whole discussion is the need for the attorney to understand what the client really wants, as outlined in your five criteria.
Absolutely.
And then, secondly, to create a budget and timeline of costs and events. And it's something that, at least when I went to school, and I understand it was an era or two ago, but nevertheless, even today's law student, we're not taught how to do this. How do lawyers intuitively know how to do this based on your experience? And if they don't know it, how do they get the skill?
Yeah, and they don't know, Ed. You're absolutely right. I know that you're an MBA. I got my MBA the hard way by running an investment banking and privatization firm for about 5 years, ran it right into the ground, you know. And so, you know, lawyers are not taught to be business people. It's a fundamental error in our legal education system. You take kids that are liberal arts majors, you put them in law school, and I don't know what they learn in law school these days, but they sure as heck don't learn the business of law, and they don't really learn how to counsel clients.
You know, the fact of their not knowing the business of law has allowed me in 1995 to actually get a registered trademark on that phrase.
Is that right?
The business of law is my trademark.
That's a fantastic trademark, and it's just right on because, I think the reason I formed my own firm was because I thought I didn't want to be a lawyer. I thought I was fed up with being a lawyer. What I learned was I didn't hate the practice of law. I hated the business of law as it was being practiced at law firms. And what brought me back to in-house practice after this little five-year experiment was the fact that at my core I'm a lawyer. I worry about our profession, and I worry about the failing of lawyers and law firms to understand that they are in a business and to understand that it is a customer service business and to understand what customer service means.
Right, absolutely. Well, after all this and the experience that you've had thus far, Jeff, what do you see as the future of alternative billing systems? What do you see as, I guess saying it another way, what do you see as the future of the relationship between lawyers and clients? Are we going to be more or less adversarial to one another?
Yeah,
are we
great
going
question.
To be more of a teamwork? Are lawyers somehow going to learn how to become team players?
That's such a great question because I think it goes to the fundamental problem in our profession today. And right now, law firms don't have a great incentive to change. If they can sell all of their hours essentially in an inelastic market that says, you know, I don't really, go ahead and bill me as many hours as you can and I'm going to continue to pay it. There's no incentive to change to some other form, and there's no incentive really for them to reduce their costs as a way of increasing their profitability. I think if this continues, this dynamic continues, and corporate counsel are getting increasingly angry about this, and corporate clients are getting increasingly angry about it, then eventually we're going to get to a situation a lot like the medical profession. We'll have some form of managed care, and we're not going to like it very much. I don't know what that form will be. I don't know, you know, maybe it's increased auditing of bills. Maybe it's people coming in saying, no, the value of that service is not $100,000, it's $75,000. Maybe there'll be a whole cottage industry that will develop. In fact, I think it's already there, that does that kind of review work. That will make it even more adversarial, as you're saying, Ed. And that's not the way this profession ought to go. I mean, you know, we're counselors. We're supposed to be solving business problems. We're supposed to be partners with our businesses. Regardless of whether you're in-house or at a firm, somehow, some way, we got to find a way to change this relationship where we are compensating our firms fairly and making them profitable. I mean, we do not want our firms to be unprofitable, but we also don't want the firms to be doing work that we don't need done and that doesn't go to our business objectives. So in my view, you need more in-house counsel that have the nerve, guts, time, chutzpah, creativity, whatever it is that you call it, to start challenging this. And you need firms that more and more say, you know, there's got to be a different way. My favorite firm in America on this issue is a little firm out in Seattle, Washington, called the Summit Law Firm. They're all refugees from the big firms. And when there's a guy named Ralph Palumbo that created the firm because he felt there was a different way to provide legal services. Every time Ralph sends out a bill or any lawyer at Summit, you know, it's hourly and it comes down to the bottom line and it says total amount of this bill and there's a number there. There's another line that says client adjustment and that line is blank. And then there's a final line that says total amount due. As a client, I have the right to do whatever I want to a Summit bill. I can give them a bonus. I can write it down to zero. Now, that's true value billing because you're empowering the client to do whatever they want to their bill. And if you call Ralph and if you ask him, well, Ralph, how many people, write it down to zero? He'll kind of laugh and he'll say, well, you know, one or two. He says, some people like you, Jeff, that you pay us bonuses and other people. But, you know, by and large, most people pay exactly the amount of the bill. And the reason they do it is they believe and understand that the bill is reasonable because they have the right to change it, and so therefore they don't need to. It's a fascinating and amazing both marketing ploy and also a partnering relationship because he's empowering his clients to say, hey, what really was the value of these services?
That's a great way to end our conversation. Jeff, thanks very much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Ed.
You have been listening to a Law Biz podcast. For more podcasts, please visit www.lawbiz.com/podcasts.html. Feel free to tell your friends and colleagues about Law Biz podcasts. You may duplicate this program in part or in whole, provided that you retain appropriate attribution and copyright notices.